Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, and also proprietor of the very fine website, the Princeton Election Consortium, election.princeton.edu.
Well, Sam, welcome to episode 100.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to believe that we've gotten this far. I was listening back to our first episode, and it's fair to say that there's a lot that's happened under President Trump that we probably would have expected. Back in episode one, we were talking about the power of partisanship in the electorate. You were skeptical that Donald Trump would fall as much as some people thought in the election and thought that the Republican Party would generally be supportive of his campaign. We talked about how unusual and odd politics had become and that we shouldn't use the old rules to predict what was going to happen, and that we shouldn't just, you know, go with assumptions from previous eras of politics and say they were going to work today. We both were thinking that Hillary Clinton was going to win. Your confidence was slightly higher than mine.
Sad.
But we were actually aware in that episode that it was not as inevitable as people were thinking. And since then, it's been a crazy whirlwind. It's been really, I think, a remarkable year plus. And so we both thought for the 100th episode that it might be interesting to talk a little bit about aspects of politics during Trump's term that still have surprised us, that have taken us back a little bit, despite what we were thinking. So listeners, we each picked a few. And mine, I'd say, even though I am a student of public distrust in government since the 1970s and the way in which our political process has really been pretty either dysfunctional or skewed in the last few decades, I'm still been surprised by public tolerance at some level for very unstable actions by the President of the United States, very, very aggressive moves on issues like immigration. And even though I know a majority don't support what's going on, it's still surprising to me to see Republicans generally stand firm, even after something like the Helsinki summit. And even the level of opposition sometimes seems muted to me, despite what you're seeing in the polls from Democrats, given the kind of activities that are in the White House.
Yeah, that's interesting. At some level, this public tolerance is, I agree with you, pretty striking. I mean, we knew when we first started this podcast that polarization was strong. We knew that people were likely to stick with their candidate, and that was why Trump was doing as well as he was doing back in the, whenever it was, in the summer and the fall of 2016. But it is really amazing the kinds of things that people are putting up with. The fact that Trump is still at above 85% of self-reported Republicans, that number of Republicans, people who report being a Republican has declined a bit, I think. But still, the ones who still say that they're Republicans are sticking with him. Generally speaking, I've frankly been a little bit puzzled by this, because if you look back, the things that Hillary Clinton said about Donald Trump in the 2016 campaign, that he was a Russian puppet, that there was collusion between his campaign and Russia, that he was going to do extreme things in regard to the environment or women's rights or what have you. Pardon my saying so, but everything she said was true. Including him being a puppet. You know, you're the puppet. No, I'm no puppet. You're the puppet. And just his incoherence and his submissiveness to Vladimir Putin, right? Like there are these things that have gone on that you would think would have gotten his own party up in arms, but it hasn't occurred. And it's got to be the case that they're getting the other stuff that they want, whether it be tax cuts or judicial nominations or cabinet appointments that they probably would have been okay with anyway. Just the general feeling that they're okay with it, and that we as citizens, or we the journalistic corps or whatever, whoever it is we is who's not an elected official, I agree with you that it's amazing that people have put up with it, as opposed to, say, I don't know, armed insurrection. Like if somebody on the left had done the left equivalent of what he did, God knows what that would be. Right. I don't know, mandatory sex or something. I'm not sure. Who knows? What would it, whatever it would be, there would be armed insurrection, like literal armed insurrection on the right. And so it is quite striking that things have stayed as amazingly stable as they have, right? I mean, especially since that, you know, as we record this, it's a pretty fresh memory what he and Putin did. And that was just actually genuinely shocking to see the president of the United States, you know, the remaining hyperpower in the U.S. And let us remind ourselves that Russia is, what, the 11th largest economy in the world. It's just, you know, it's, with no offense to our Russian colleagues out there, it's a cruddy, washed-up country, and it's basically filled with corruption. And all they have left is educated people who are able to hack computers. And that's kind of what they have left. And then they stuck it to us. And then the president of the United States somehow in the thrall of this man for reasons that we still don't know.
Yeah, and it's kind of a lesson of the Trump years. There's all these things you thought you could never see someone do. And he does it, whether it's that moment, which for many people will always stand out, or just his daily tweets. And I don't know, things continue. There are protests, and there's hopefully going to be responses from everyone who has strong feelings that actually manifest themselves in some way through voting, through other forms of political activism. But still, he does a lot. And I think he understands at some level that there is room for doing this in American political culture circa 2018.
Now, does this mean that we as a society and as a nation are resilient and good at continuity? Or does it mean that we have like this massive momentum going in? We can't steer the ship, even though there's this giant iceberg that's in our noses.
Well, that's fine. I mean, so the positive way is our institutions are strong from our political to economic institutions, so they continue. But the other is we can't actually resist things like this, that we're much weaker politically, culturally than we thought. And so there's room for this kind of activity at the highest levels of power. Nothing really is going to happen other than people getting angry and yelling and screaming. But in the end, life moves on, but that's not a source of strength. It's in fact can be seen as where we have descended to or how things have disintegrated.
Yes.
Anyway, what's one of yours?
Well, it's kind of, you know, these are all at some level continuations of each other. I'll say that one thing that's really occurred to me is just watching our third branch of government, which I thought was the most stable and reliable branch of government, the judicial branch. One thing I've noticed is I've gotten really interested in watching the Supreme Court, both through, you know, some things that I've been working on, but also just as an observer, what I would say, some combination of passivity and continuity on the part of the judicial branch. And so the positive surprise is that judges and courts seem to still be doing their job, that they will occasionally, you know, issue injunctions to prevent some implementation, say, of an Obamacare provision. But I don't know how to put it, but just sort of a combination of continuity and also passivity. So if you look at this year's Supreme Court term, things like the Muslim ban, which got watered down in lower courts several times, but in the end was upheld by the Supreme Court. And that's interesting to me because there's this disconnect between the Supreme Court sticking up for, say, Christian bakers in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, but then also allowing certain Muslims from being banned from entering the United States, and that's the Trump versus Hawaii case. And so I've detected a certain passivity by the court. A lot of it was the last year of Anthony Kennedy, and he returned to his conservative roots and didn't act on partisan gerrymandering, despite the fact that politics is more broken than ever, and we're seeing the extreme fruits of partisanship and polarization. And yet there's this, you know, in some ways they're not better than we are. In some ways the Supreme Court is also acting in continuity and acting to hive off the worst offenses, but not really stepping up and recognizing a new status quo in society. There's something they're not doing. And it's, in some ways, it occurred to me as you were talking about public tolerance of extreme moves, in some ways the judicial branch's passivity is sort of the same thing. They're adapting in some ways well, but also in some ways very slowly and not responding fully to the destabilization that we're seeing. An example would be it's emerging that Brett Kavanaugh turns out to be very critical of the independent counsel statute, which of course has expired. But that's somewhat telling that he's okay with executive branch power and he's okay with relative lack of oversight. And that, you know, my guess is that he's going to stick with that. And that tells us that in some sense, this weird Trumpism that we're encountering is also itself a continuation of something that's been going on for the last couple of years.
Do you think the courts are passive, or is it that the courts have shifted to the right and are basically aligned with a lot of what the White House is doing? So there's just not a lot of points of discontinuity anymore. And I don't know the answer to that, but it's something I wonder about.
That could be. So in other words, that where the Republican Party is at is not so far from where their appointees are at, and where Trump is at is not so far from trends that we've been watching for the last two decades. And we're just seeing these trends really kind of flame up into full, you know, whatever, erupting into sores or whatever. And so we're just seeing the whole thing blow up into like just a god-awful attack of anti-institutionitis. And so maybe they're okay with it. Yeah, it could be that therefore there's not that much daylight between what they are inclined to do and what's happening in the executive branch. Possible.
Yeah, so the second one for me is white nationalism and how it's made its way into, you know, mainstream politics. We have Charlottesville was about a year ago where the country saw this front and center in terms of an alt-right that had organized nationally as if it was some legitimate kind of political organization. You've seen congressional candidates running using anti-Semitic, nativist, even racist language. You've seen the president's Twitter stream often retweet voices from this world, and places like Breitbart and other social media sites carry the message. And it is really remarkable. And again, for someone who has studied the growth of these movements and their constant presence in American politics, they've just moved very often out of the fringe now, right into the inner circles of politics. And I think it's been pretty stunning to me to watch that.
Well, the way I would put it is this, that those elements have always been with us. If we think back to the John Birch Society, Father Coughlin, I mean, you're a scholar of these things. These movements have been around. The nuttery of people like Joe McCarthy, these kinds of hateful, vile sentiments, and, you know, less vile, but just not very nice. There's a spectrum of vileness. But anyway, when the major parties are each 40% of the population, then the worst 10% of the population is no more than a fourth of the party, right? So I'm just going to do some nerdy arithmetic here. And so if Republicans are 40%, then let's say the John Birchers or the white supremacists are 10%, then they're just a fourth. What could they do? Then Republicans become, you know, 30% of the population. Well, now they're a third. And as parties get weaker and as affiliations get weaker, I mean, we've talked about this before, it becomes possible for them to have a voice. And with Trump, we basically got to some threshold where it's possible for some major faction to rise up and become part of the conversation. I mean, at some level, I agree with you that it's incredible that it's flamed up the way it has, but it was always there. And so I guess the question is, broadly, what are the conditions that allowed them to come bubble up to the surface?
I mean, part of it is also the absence of gatekeepers in national communication or international communication is pretty clear now. I do think sites like Twitter and Facebook and all of them have just opened the door to fringe voices or not always fringe, but at least outside of the mainstream, to just communicate with a huge bully pulpit.
Right.
And the ease of getting some of these ideas into even what the national media is talking about or what politicians are talking about is just phenomenal. I don't think
Sure.
we've totally reckoned with it.
Yeah, yeah. Disintermediation of information. I mean, people in tech love to talk in kind of a patronizing way about how great it is to level the playing field for information. And really, I'm going to let my anchor out a little bit here. Just reflects this incredible naivete by like all these, you know, bros who think that technology is going to solve everything. And then there's Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook going around saying that, well, he's not going to regulate the voices of people who deny the occurrence and the horror of the Holocaust. And it's okay for those voices to come out. And the failure of Twitter to regulate certain kinds of hate speech, it just, it really reveals that there's that that there's this weakness in our society in the form of mass communication that you're describing, where it's just easy for emotional bad ideas, wrong ideas, to get amplified, because hot ideas and hot emotions are more likely to get repeated. And so it's just anything that's cool or reasoned or fact-checked is at a natural disadvantage, right? It's like the saying goes that a lie can go around the world, halfway around the world, before the truth is put on its boots. And Facebook and Twitter reduce that time down to a fraction of a second. So it's just, I think that that's got to be an amplifying feature. And it suggests to me, frankly, a need to regulate these kinds of communication in some way, whether the European Union is going to do it for us. I think we're too broken as a nation to do a good job of regulating, at least under current political conditions. It just it does feel like a major weakness, an underbelly of American life, that that on the one hand, information is liberated, and so it's great to get information easily. On the other hand, bad information is also liberated, as well as other kinds of information.
Yeah, I feel like we're having a huge technological hangover or something. And we had earlier in the year, David Kushner was on. I think you were away that week, but he was speaking about hacking and same kind of thing. There was all this great emotion about all these social network technology in the last decade, about everyone, the ease of communication. And now we're learning that also opens the doors to all kinds of bad hacking and manipulation of elections and financial information and more. And it's the same with this issue of who gets to communicate and how easily they get to communicate in a legitimate platform. I think we're maturing in trying to understand how this all works. And I don't know if there'll be a response, either regulatory or self-regulatory, from some of these companies.
Well, one place that might, just to return to it, I think one place that could be a source of regulation would be the European Union, just on grounds that that when it comes to regulation of this kind of technology, the EU starting point is that privacy is very important, that individual rights are important, and they don't necessarily value, say, the growth of corporations and the rightness of the market the way that the U.S. does. And so in the U.S., maybe we think that the market's going to fix all things because market forces are so powerful. Yeah, market forces are like an idiot god that are really good at making certain things super efficient. I'd love for, maybe it's good for market forces to regulate how much my rideshare costs, maybe. But is it so good for those same market forces to regulate which ideas float to the top on Facebook?
Yeah. Okay, what's your second? I gave you two. What's
okay, all right. So you know what? I had an order. I'm going to go out of order because it's sort of the flip side of what you're talking about. It's something that struck me, and I was going to save this for the end. But I will say one thing that's really interesting to me in the face of these strange, disruptive national events is everyday life in many ways has stayed the same. So people are relatively decent in everyday life. Now, I will say that I live in a pretty protected environment, and I'm in a demographic that is relatively protected. But I generally found that that in everyday life, people are pretty decent. I just want to tell a story just for a moment. I went for fireworks over in South Brunswick, which is a few miles away here in Princeton. And it was Friday after July 4th, so it was on July 6th. And my family and I were there on the fairgrounds. And I just looked around, and it was people of different races. So it was, a variety, ethnically diverse community. It was peaceful. It was a festive feeling. It was this holiday atmosphere. And this is going to sound really silly and sentimental, but I walked up to this food truck, and it's a halal food truck. And I'm like, all right, well, in central New Jersey, and it's a halal food truck. And I look there, and they're selling cheesesteaks. And I'm like, my reaction is, we're here for fireworks. We got our halal cheesesteak going here. God bless America. I love New Jersey. And so it was this feeling that a lot of things that happen at a local level and a state level are going on the same, and that whether it be town councils or neighborhood associations, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe I just have a little micro sample of our country, but it has struck me that a lot of things have stayed the same. I know that on one of our podcasts, James Fallows came on to right. talk about his book, Our Towns. And that was interesting that he also talked about the strength and the consistency of local communities. And I think that that's a strength of American society that in some ways is really disconnected from the national scene. And some of it comes out even in national politics, because neighborhood associations where, on the left, resistance movements, mostly of women, also of men, but these movements that have come up almost spontaneously at a local level. And so one thing that struck me that's been somewhat surprising to me is both everyday decency and also just popular reaction to what's going on in the news. And it's in some ways, it's kind of jarring how normal things are in everyday life.
Well, that's the flip side, I guess, of the first point we were discussing, in that the normality or regularity of local life, not simply generating political movements, but just operating, being functional, is also, that would be the continuity argument, that there is an element of that, and the disconnect between national and local life has this important value if things are not going well, or highly unstable, at least, at the national level. And that Fallows conversation, that's what his whole book was about, and making a strong argument that that's what he saw in his travels before and after this presidency. Many things were running the same. I guess you have to balance that between that being a virtue and that allowing for things that could potentially have really huge ramifications or already having huge ramifications, and the public doesn't do anything because their local life is so normal or so functional.
Right, right.
My third and final one, which I think a lot about, and it's a story that had a lot of attention early on, and now you hear dribbles of it, and that's just the way in which conflict, really massive conflict of interest right now, has been normalized. For me, that's a really important story of the Trump presidency. Here's this guy who owned a massive global business with clear connections between the business and policy decisions that the government makes, from Washington to overseas. Many members of the administration, including his daughter and son-in-law, have the same problem. Very weak firewalls were created to really deal with this problem. You have the weekly advertisement for whatever resort he goes to. And yet, like some of these other issues, it's been surprising how little pushback there has been. Even from political opponents, it hasn't ranked as really the highest issue. And I don't know. It seems to set up, really a problematic realm of governance, including if this is allowed after he's out of office, if this is again normalized. It's going backwards from where Watergate left us.
I wouldn't even say conflicts of interest. I mean, the phrase conflict of interest, if I understand it correctly, is meant to address issues like the appearance of corruption. But we're talking about open corruption, where the Chinese government grants trademarks to the daughter of the president of the United States, or where Russian banks have lent hundreds of millions of dollars that we don't even know about to the president, who has not disclosed his tax returns. Scott Pruitt, Wilbur Ross, Steve Mnuchin, just over and over again. Interesting. I would call it, just open corruption that reminds me of things that I've read about the Gilded Age. Now, one thing that's interesting to me there is that I'm curious about how far down that percolates, because these are at the highest levels of office and at the level of political appointees. And I'm curious about whether it's possible to get away with these things at a lower level, because at least in levels that I can see in my everyday life, it's not like state government has become more corrupt. It's just at these very high levels. And so I agree with you that there are these massive conflicts, open corruption. I think it comes back, again, not to stick everything onto a few causes, but it shows us what single-party government leads to, at least single-party government in its current form, that there is no oversight over these conflicts that are happening in the executive branch, that when one branch of government runs amok, if other branches don't step up, at least under current political conditions, we have a gentleman's and gentlewomen's agreement to behave in everyday life in a decent manner. And so we don't really have very good mechanisms for this massive corruption that that's become apparent. And I, you know, it is an interesting question how long it'll last. I think it's going to probably depend on the outcome of this November's election, where we're going to find out who controls the House and who controls the Senate after November. And I think that's probably going to have some that's going to set the tone a bit, because then if our airwaves are filled with investigations of corruption, then that's interesting. And, you know, and I will say we don't yet know whether Scott Pruitt, for instance, is going to get away with all his corruption. I forget who it is, but one of these other corrupt officials has to start giving back hundreds of thousands of dollars in benefits illegally obtained. So I think that you're right that it's just such a massive proliferation of conflicts and corruption that it's just too much to deal with. And you know, it's a real test of our society, whether we can come to terms with it in the coming years.
I mean, historically, the only time these things culminate in some action reforms is when there's just huge scandals front and center. And I guess maybe the scandals of Scott Pruitt or Tom Price or some of the cabinet officials have not been big enough. I mean, that could be the other factor in addition to United Government. But obviously, the president himself and his company and the decisions he makes that are related to his company, it's pretty, you know, in the post-Watergate age, you'd think that wouldn't be acceptable anymore.
Yeah, but people need, I think there's a need for concrete information. So, for instance, I think the story changed quite a bit when Robert Mueller released the indictments of 12 Russian operatives hacking the U.S. presidential campaign. I mean, that was, in some level, that was really kind of a strong moment that made things much more concrete in a way that partisans yelling at each other didn't really quite do. So I think that there's that kind of thing. After the November elections, if Democrats control either chamber or Congress, then they have the power to release President Trump's tax returns. And I think there are a lot of these problems that are at the level of looking like partisan warfare. So, for instance, if you look back at statements that Hillary Clinton made during the presidential campaign in 2016, to my ears, she was remarkably prescient about what Trump was going to be like as president. And it's amazing the kinds of things that she said. But, you know, trust in Hillary Clinton was not high in major segments of the population. And I think it fell on deaf ears. But if we have a concrete document that's tax returns, if we have indictments from the Department of Justice, if we have convictions of Paul Manafort, it feels to me like these things are going to become real in a way that they haven't been. And I guess, my hope in our institutions would be that the test of whether those statements that might be true turn out to be really true once measured in a court of law. One possible hope would lie in that opening eyes and really getting us all reset and facing in the same direction. I don't know that it's going to happen, but certainly all the indications are that these little glimmerings that we've been hearing about are as bad as we think. Every worst thing that we've imagined has turned out to be true.
So what is your final surprise of the Trump presidency?
Well, a little anticlimactic, but one thing that's really struck me is the staying power of popular sentiment. I do think that at least for the time being, popular anger has, you know, held up pretty well. I remember the first outpouring of rage on the part of, I would say, not only the left, but I think of a lot of people, a lot of decent people, at the Muslim ban, which at some level was an unforced error by the administration, but it really captured a feeling. And likewise, the Women's March, which there were questions at that time about whether the Women's March was going to have staying power. But I think those things are now starting to get turned into action. We've seen in district after district, state after state, women running for office, and they're really sticking with it. We've seen phenomena like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez running for Congress, with MJ Heger down in Texas. I could go on, candidate after candidate, women who have come out of the woodwork and who would not have necessarily been running for office in, I think, more peaceful and calm times, coming out. I think that the popular anger that we've seen, if you look at polling data, it's looking like it's holding up pretty well. There are a number of indicators that it's really holding up. Within our polarized society, opinion has swung about as far as one can imagine opinions swinging, although, you know, there is kind of weird that to my mind that it hasn't swung further. But I think that popular anger has held up pretty well, and I'm starting to sense pretty good commitment on the part of people who feel injured, who feel left out. And I think there's some question about how it's going to play out, and we are going to find out in about less than 4 months in November, exactly what happens at the ballot box. But one thing that struck me is that there has been a pretty sustained reaction of outrage. Now, you know, that will be tested in a very real way in less than 120 days.
Right. How does the outrage turn into voting?
Yeah.
Or if it doesn't.
Yeah. And I think, you know, honestly, I mean, if I'm going to like get back to my, you know, poll analyzing ways, I think at least one chamber of Congress is going to switch control. And I wouldn't be too surprised if both did. So I think that, you know, we're going to find out. And then down ticket, right? So there's been a certain attrition for Democrats on the down ticket because they've just done kind of a lousy job of really of having local officials. I think Republicans are quite good at working with local opinion. And so I think we're about to see whether there's this kind of reset in American politics at a down ticket level as people get engaged. You know, and we don't know the answer to that yet. It'll be interesting to see whether these very strange national events percolate down to, you know, whatever, town councils, school boards, legislative seats.
All right. Well, happy 100th episode, Sam.
Yes, likewise. Should we have baked a cake or?
Should have had a cake or some sound effects maybe or
yes.
Something. So everyone, thanks for joining us on Politics and Polls. Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify, and we'll be back soon.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.